This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
So today's interview is going to be with Mike Lockwood of Southampton University, who's been doing some research on the variability, the long-term variability of the solar output. Could you first explain the 11-year cycle of the sun?
Yes, the sun activity waxes and wanes about 11-year time scale. Mm-hmm. The reason is that essentially it gets its magnetic field in a twist and it has to clear it out, sort it out, and it's just about sorted out and the whole process starts again. And that sort of activity cycle that results from that, we know from sunspot records, is the by far the normal behavior of our sun. Over the last few millennia, we see cycles that we can relate to that magnetic activity cycle on the sun.
So, yeah, were you referring to a longer term, a cycle, longer, like we are just coming out of a grand maxima? How long did the grand maxima last for?
On top of these cycles, 11-year cycles of activity, as you say, there are long-term variations. Now, the whole space age has been embedded within a grand maxima of solar activity. By grand maxima, I mean we can tell that it's in the top 10% of solar activity levels, and has been for about 50, 60 years. We can tell this from cosmogenic isotopes, cosmic ray products that get deposited in reservoirs that we can date. So this is things like tree trunks, ocean sediments, ice sheets, anything where we can drill in and date the deposition. And we can see the 11-year cycles in those cosmogenic isotopes, but we also see they're superposed on these long-term variations. And we've been in this top 10% of activity for about 50 to 60 years now. The lowest that minimum that we've seen, not in the whole record, there are low ones, but the famous one is the Maunder minimum, mm-hmm. which persisted from about 1650 to 1700, so the second half of the 17th century. And we see that in cosmogenic isotopes, and we class that as a grand solar minimum. Mm-hmm. And so you seem to go from minimum to maximum over a timescale of 300, 400, 500 years in general when you look at the whole sequence. Yeah. And then the minima and the maxima last for somewhere between 50 or 100 years.
Okay. But it would be naive to assume that as we fall out of the grand maxima, that this would decrease the global warming. It's more complicated.
Yes. I mean, I wish that were true. I wish that the sun were coming to our rescue and it would mitigate the effects of man-made greenhouse gas trapping. Unfortunately, although we are now seeing lower irradiance values than we've ever seen before, as they say, since records began, but...
Could you explain that, please, irradiances?
Oh, okay. Irradiance is... we call it the total solar radiance. It's the integral of the power over the whole spectrum, so from UV through to infrared. It's dominated by the visible wavelengths, in fact. And it's the power per unit area falling on the disk that's presented to the sun by our planet and its atmosphere. So it's a number typically around 1,366 is the sort of canonical number of the what used to be called the solar constant, but now we know it varies. We call it the total solar irradiance, and it goes up and down. Paradoxically, when there are more spots on the sun, there are also more what are called small flux tubes, called faculae, and these small flux tubes, they actually increase the brightness. And for every sunspot, there's 1,000 faculae, and so actually the net effect of more spots is a brighter sun. And we've seen about a 0.1% variation from between solar minimum and solar maximum. But now the present solar minimum has hit lower values than we've seen in the solar minima before. The other thing to qualify is I said since records began. Unfortunately, records in this case only begin in 1978. So we have only a very short sequence. Even that sequence is hard to put together. Radiometry from space is a very difficult thing to do to these levels of accuracy. And there is debate about whether the various instruments have been cross-calibrated correctly and all the rest of it. But we're gaining more confidence that we're doing that right. So we are seeing lower values, but it's a very small effect. To put it in context, the sort of changes that we get out of changes in Earth's orbit around the Sun are much greater, okay, at least 10 times larger. And in fact, they have most effect not through changing the total solar radiance, but actually by changing the pattern of insulation of, so the way the sunlight falls on our planet makes big changes to the climate, and that's really what drives the ice ages and things. So these measurements aren't a harbinger for us being plunged into an ice age, which would not be good, but nor are they actually anything to get excited about in terms of mitigating the effects of man-made global warming.
So we're dropping out of a grand maxima, and so you say we're going to for sort of the next 50, 60 years. What implications does that have for us? Is the temperature going to pretty much stay the same? Is it going to drop? Or
Let's deal with the global warming issue first. There does seem to be some effect that takes solar variability and amplifies it in our climate record. There are a few postulated mechanisms for this. For example, the ultraviolet part of the spectrum is much more variable than the visible part, but it doesn't carry a great power with it, and it tends to be absorbed high up in the atmosphere. But then there are theories why this large amplitude variation might percolate down and have an effect in the troposphere. Most of the ultraviolet is absorbed in the stratosphere by ozone, of course. So some of it might actually make it through to the surface. So that, and another slightly much more controversial suggestion is cosmic rays help produce clouds, and so you introduce a solar modulation that way. But there does seem to be something that amplifies the solar effect. The solar effect consistently comes out a bit bigger than you would expect, factor of 3 or 4, but still quite small compared to the other drivers in terms of climate. But actually, I'd like to mention an almost completely different thing, which is an interesting facet of all this, which I didn't have time to get onto in my talk earlier today. And that is the space weather side of this, because lower solar activity generally means lower average disruption, the sort of thing the sun can do. The sun can disrupt satellite communications. It can cause satellites to die. You can embed charge and burn out satellite parts. Power systems are disrupted, all sorts of things like that. There's a whole plethora of what we call space weather effects. Now, on average, they should decline as we come out, and we have this been looking at the sun in a strangely active period for the last 50 years. However, there is evidence that the biggest single events, the biggest storms, actually all take place at rather middling solar activity levels. So halfway between the morning minimum and now. For example, the big flare that started the whole field off was the Carrington flare in 1859, which was observed by Richard Carrington. And it was the first time we really saw the effects on Earth of a solar flare. And there was a lot of debate about it at the time, but we now understand that interaction chain. And there are a number of papers around that estimate the global damage that would be done by an event of that size. And we're talking tens to hundreds of billions of dollars worth of damage. I mean, this is in terms of lost systems and lost. It's incredible. The knock-on effects are huge. Now, we can tell from the solar energetic particles that are produced by such events produce nitrates in the atmosphere that are then deposited into ice sheets. And so we can look at these events, and we can see the event that happened during the Apollo era that would have killed all the Apollo astronauts. All these events we can see in the nitrate record in the ice sheet. And they all occur at rather middling solar activity levels. They don't occur at the highest levels. So paradoxically, it may well be that we get fewer events overall and smaller events on average, but the big ones are more likely to occur. I draw an analogy rather like losing your temper. If you lose your temper on a regular basis, it's no big deal. You lose your temper every day. If you're one of those people that actually keep the cool, you know, store it up, then when you do go, then tends to be a goodie, okay? And it's a little bit like that with the sun, that I think if the activity levels are on average lower, that when it does go with a big event, you tend to get a super large event. And so there are possible implications, because when you look at, like, the insurance industry, what they worry about is coordinated failures. They can set premiums based on the idea that these things happen at random. But when there's an underlying cause that will cause a whole load of things to happen at the same time, like satellites going out, power distribution grids across the world being affected, rather than just in one region, then they have a big problem. And so coordinated failures are a real problem. And so these super events could be quite significant. I can't say that for sure. We've never been here before. We haven't been a high-tech society in a average-level sun before. We've only ever been in a high-level active sun before. Interesting times.
So as the sun is already overdue in its life cycle, what do we have to expect for to happen in the next few years?
Oh, sooner or later. I mean, there was evidence presented in the session earlier today that what's really happening is the old cycle hasn't finished yet. This actually homes in on a big debate about how the sun works and how the cycles replace each other. I personally believe that you need flux of a new polarity to emerge, make its way to the poles, and it cancels out the flux. And you tend to get long low minima where it's having trouble getting it started in the opposite direction field. So the evidence is rather, because we still don't have a nice simple solar minimum streamer belt and things. So the evidence rather is that the new cycle is not doing enough to replace the old cycle, and we're stuck in the middle for a little while. That would be my view of what's actually happening now. I think something rather similar happened during the space age, actually, right at the beginning, because the largest solar cycle we know about and the most active sun that we know about, bar none actually, almost, was around in the late 50s, early 60s. It was a huge peak in the solar activity then. And then the cycle after that was very strange. It was very long, it was very low level, and I think the sun was having trouble getting rid of the remnant magnetic flux left over from the previous cycle. And we may be in that sort of situation. I would expect from here that the average activity levels will decline. They may kick up again for a bit. And over a 200-300 year period, we will end up in another of the grand solar minimum like the Maunder minimum. So, but one can never second guess the sun. We don't understand this process, the dynamo process, well enough to actually predict what's actually going to happen. We're making strides in describing it, but a true predictive capability is still beyond us. And so I can't tell if it's going to kick on off again or drop down, but on a long enough time scale, centuries, then it's going to drop, and we will head from this maximum right down into a Maunder minimum. So but I would never put any money on when that will happen. I would be unwise to, anyway.
So for the listeners, could you just explain why this recent solar cycle is so peculiar in comparison to the past ones?
Okay, there's a lot of things about that. I've mentioned that the power we receive from the sun has hit values lower than we've ever seen before. The sunspot number always goes to near zero, every solar minimum. One of the rather deceptive things about the sun is that the number of spots on it, which is a useful indicator because it goes right back to about 1650, we have pretty good measurements from amateur observers and the like, right back to then. And so it's a very useful record like that. But one of the problems with it is that every solar minimum, the sun goes clean of spots, irrespective of the underlying state of the sun. So people tend to think that it gets a fresh start at every solar minimum, whereas actually there is a residual effect from what's gone before in there. So the geomagnetic activity that the sun drives is the lowest that we've seen actually for about 80 years. You've got to go back 80 years because we have a good long record of geomagnetic record data. The open magnetic flux that we can deduce from spacecraft measurements is at an all-time low. Again, we can extrapolate that back with geomagnetic activity records, and we have to go back to about 1920 before we find values this low. The biggest thing, the thing that's really surprising, is the solar wind is at its thinnest. The density of the solar wind is lower than we've ever seen before. Now, I can't tell you how that fits in the long-term context because we haven't yet devised a way of reconstructing that from back before the space age. But that's a really big change, and that really is something we don't understand, so that's interesting. Unfortunately, I can't put that in historical context for you because all we have are the space age data on that. Yeah. So there's a lot of parameters that are actually showing an all-time low. The magnetic field that we receive from the sun in interplanetary space is lower than at any time since, again, reconstructive values back in the 20s.
Until the recent years, the actual cosmic ray intensity has been increasing, despite this drop in solar activity. Could you expand on that, please?
Well, it's not despite, it's because of. Cosmic rays we're shielded from, there's two effects. There's the geomagnetic field, that changes very slowly, and in a way that actually we know quite a lot about. So the geomagnetic shield is understood and can be factored out of this. The other is the solar magnetic field, and we know, you can see very clear 11-year cycles, but when the sun is at an activity maximum, you get a minimum number of cosmic rays. Because what really shields us is the magnetic field that comes out of the sun in the solar wind, and it's actually structure in that can actually scatter individual cosmic rays. So they kind of play pinball as they try to get in, and the number reaching us at the center of the heliosphere goes down, and it goes down most when you've got the highest activity. So until recently, the cosmic ray fluxes were just going up and up, which is a symptom of this lower and lower solar activity. Somebody, Ola Wolfordale, commented in the session earlier that actually in the last few weeks it's turned over. Well, you know, it takes more than a few weeks to determine a trend. So that may indeed be the start of the next activity cycle and things are going down. But we've seen a lot of false dawns from 3 years ago, people were saying, oh, here's the new solar cycle, and it hasn't happened yet. It keeps, all the symptoms of a new solar cycle keep fizzling out. They are strange days. We haven't been here before. And of course, that makes it exciting days for scientists because it's only when things change that the true mechanisms become revealed. So it's going to test all our theories in lots of ways.
I was just going to give us a brief background on what Ulysses does and.
Ulysses was a joint ESA-NASA mission. Doesn't get a lot of publicity, which is a shame because it's done something incredibly valuable. What it's done is it's been able to show that there's no latitudinal structure in the heliospheric field. We have a good idea why this is. This wasn't a prediction, though. It was one of those sort of post-dictions where everybody said, oh, of course, and came up with a reason after they knew the fact. But what Ulysses found was that the radial field was just about independent of the heliographic latitude. And that's really useful because it means you can take a point measurement and work out the total magnetic flux in the heliosphere. And that's the key parameter for example, the cosmic ray shield. And we think it's because, actually, when you get near the sun, the so-called plasma beta is very... think about it, is very low. The things are dominated by the magnetic pressure. And that allows slightly non-radial solar wind to actually even out the magnetic field close into the sun. And then, of course, it's frozen in and that stays throughout the heliosphere. So it means we can measure at one point the sun rotates, so we can average out the longitudinal structure of the sun by just averaging over a solar rotation period. And we don't have to worry about the latitudinal structure because Ulysses has told us that there isn't any. And as I say, we think we now understand that in terms of the magnetic pressure dominating the flow close in, and you get slightly non-radial flow until the tangential pressure is equalized, which means the radial magnetic field is equalized. So we think this is sort of sets in very close to the sun, and then we can see that. So it's actually provided this incredibly useful result that lets us quantify the whole heliosphere from a single point measurement. Yes, it's almost too good to be true, isn't it? When I first found the result in the library, I worked right through a number of things, and I thought all I need now is some way of putting in a model variation for the latitude structure of the heliospheric field. And I went to his paper by Andre Blog from Ulysses, and I read it. I was very, very tired. I'd been working flat out for a long period of time. And I read it, and I thought, I am hallucinating. I am reading on the page, not what it says, but what I want to read. So I just closed it up. I was seriously quite worried about myself. I closed it up, and I went home and had a bottle of wine with my wife, and then came back in the morning and hardly dared open the journal up again. It was in Science. So I opened it up and read it, and it still said what I'd read the night before. So I was quite relieved about my sanity, but I was also more than happy, because it meant that I had a way of taking these near-Earth measurements and making a deduction about the Sun and the heliosphere globally. It's an incredibly useful result, and Ulysses doesn't get much publicity. It's been very, very valuable in a very quiet way. It's not produced anything spectacular, but it's been very valuable. And it was the only satellite that could have done this. It's the only satellite to systematically look at the heliosphere outside of the ecliptic plane of the planets. Our view has been very much from within the ecliptic plane. So we were bound to find something really interesting from it. And we did.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the coronal holes, because you're saying the magnetic field strength is independent of latitude. Mm-hmm. Are the coronal holes too small for that to screw the result? I mean, I'm assuming that the magnetic field does change over the coronal holes.
It probably doesn't change at this independence of latitude. It really sets in at about 10 to 20 solar radii away from the sun. As I say, the flow is probably just a few degrees off radial. Normally, the solar wind flow is pretty close to radial, but you can get these slightly non-radial flows that equalize it out, and it's a gradual process until the tangential pressure is equalized. The coronal holes are really where, what you find is where the magnetic field lines don't open up much. You get faster flow coming out. And it's to do with the divergence of the field lines from the surface out through the coronal atmosphere. And what you're really seeing in coronal holes is where the material has been taken out in fast solar wind. So, in a way, that's an almost independent thing from this latitudinal invariance. So the coronal holes don't actually perturb this, and it holds whether there are coronal holes going around underneath or normal photosphere. It doesn't affect this result. Okay. But it may even be the other way around, that this effect actually changes the divergence of magnetic flux tubes as you come out into the heliosphere. That certainly affects the speed of the solar wind, and that's what produces, it's fast solar wind that produces the lack of density in the coronal hole. So it may almost be the other way around, that coronal holes tend to form in a way that is controlled by how the solar field changes as you move out into the heliosphere.
Okay. So just for the listeners, could you explain what a coronal hole is?
A coronal hole is an area on the sun. It's almost like a hole in the atmosphere. So if you think of the sun being lagged with an atmosphere, you can see in, because it's very hot, the solar atmosphere, you see it in things like X-ray images of the sun. You actually can see through to the photosphere, which is relatively cool and dark, but only in certain patches. And it looks like a sort of cladding around the sun where chunks have been taken out. And what that really is you're getting fast solar wind coming out from those coronal holes, and that depletes the atmosphere, so you get lower plasma density, and you don't get the emission from the hot, dense gas that you have elsewhere. So they're really regions where a lot of flux emerges out into the heliosphere. And it's probably true that most of the flux we see in the heliosphere has actually originated from polar coronal holes. There is one school of thought that says that all the fast solar wind we see is comes out of coronal holes, and then the slow solar wind actually comes from the edges of coronal holes and nothing from in between. But that's not the only way of looking at it. So.
Okay.
Just to finish off, could you tell me a little bit about your research, please, what you do, just in a summary?
I'm one of these people that do an awful lot of different things. I guess I get bored easily, so I move around. I started off studying the aurora. That's how I got into this, because understanding the aurora, one of the key things is understanding how the energy gets from the solar wind flow into the magnetosphere and is manifested in the aurora. So when you look following the energy, which led to an understanding of the coupling between the solar wind and and Earth's magnetic field. And that same energy is essentially drives or geomagnetic activity. And then I got interested in why the historic records of geomagnetic activity were so different from today's values. There's an index called the AA index that was put together by a priest, actually, manually looking at continuous records from Australia and from the UK. 3 hour by 3 hour, he did 100 years worth, and 3 hour by 3 hours. He was a priest, in fact, so he obviously had time on his hands and used it very well because it was an incredibly valuable record, and he did a really good job. It's very accurate what he did. And it shows this long-term change, and I kept thinking, well, why is that? And because I had done the research on how energy gets into the magnetosphere, I understood how I could relate that to long-term changes in the solar wind. And that's where the Ulysses story came in, because then I said, okay, that's all very well. It's telling me about the solar wind and the magnetic field at Earth, but I want to know about the whole sun type thing. And that's where the Ulysses result came in so useful. Because that led to the inevitable conclusion that it's just about becoming accepted now, although it's taken 10 years. There's been a lot of resistance to the idea of long-term variability in the solar atmosphere. That sort of led me into climate change stuff, and I've been interested in the analyses of long-term climate change and what it does and doesn't show you. Normally, my role has been to prove that potential solar links actually don't hold up. And so there's no point, if there isn't a link, there's no point in pursuing the idea that there is, and that you're better to get that out the way and start dealing with things properly. So, but I'm always interested. I take an interested view in these things. And global climate change science is fascinating stuff, actually. There's so many elements of science in there that it's unbelievable. It's really interesting. So one can bury oneself into all sorts of things like ocean circulation patterns, and it's amazing. But out of that as well comes the use of long-term records, like the cosmogenic isotope records. There will be a climate signal in the cosmogenic isotope records, in the same way there's a geomagnetic field signal and a solar signal. And you have to treat these things in a rather holistic way so that you deal with everything in a self-consistent way. It's a really interesting area. So I do all sorts of stuff. I enjoy it all.
Anyone got any other questions? Okay, so thank you very much, Mike.
Okay, you're welcome.